You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a gloomy, overcast day.
Dismal day.
Drizzle, Don. Drizzle.
There we go. Day in Northern California. The temperature right now. My thanks to the listener years ago who said, always state the date of the program at the beginning of the program.
Yep.
It is December 10th, 2025, as Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast, December 11, 2025, and the temperature is 45 degrees. Just for the record, if you don't happen to live in the Sacramento Valley, the temperature has basically been 45 degrees now for 11 days, with one break in the middle several days ago. I have to go back to the 1980s to remember a weather episode such as we've been going through here. Let's just go ahead through this week. Let's look forward for a moment, then we'll look back.
Drizzle.
Yeah, pretty much. It's 45 degrees and overcast at the University Airport on the west side of the UC Davis campus, and the humidity is 100%. The humidity at that weather station has been 100% for 9 days. This nice low will be 41. With patchy dense fog. Thursday, decreasing clouds. I'll believe it when I see it. The high will be 46 degrees. Thursday night, patchy fog, 41 degrees. Friday, partly sunny, 46 degrees. So decreasing clouds will be 46 degrees. Partly sunny will be 46 degrees. Friday night, 40 degrees, partly cloudy. Saturday, 46 degrees and partly sunny. Saturday night, 41 degrees and patchy fog. Sunday, okay, folks. Start dancing. Sunday, partly sunny, 54 degrees. Woo. Sunday night, patchy fog, 43 degrees. Monday, this is a big, big change here. A slight chance of showers Monday, patchy fog, and otherwise mostly cloudy, but a high near 56. And Tuesday, a chance of showers with a high near 59. So finally, a break in this two-week-long episode of high pressure trapping the valley fog. There have been lots of great satellite images people have been posting all over social media of this giant bathtub that we live in that is filled with fog. And any direction you go, you can get out of it. But here we have had essentially a four-degree temperature range, literally a four-degree temperature range for the last 7 days. I've been tracking this and sending this to my friends who live in colder climates so that they can laugh at us for once. The lowest point in the last 7 days was 39 degrees. Other than that, it's basically been 40 to 41 degrees is the low, 44 to 45 degrees is the high, 100% humidity, zero evapotranspiration rate for the last 7 days straight. Then 7 days back, we had one day when it was a little breezy and we had some sun. And remember, prior to that, we had 6 days of this, only slightly warmer. Solar input is very, very low. We're definitely catching up on chilling hours for fruit trees, let me tell you. 3 weeks ago, we had had basically zero. And of the last 6 years, we were way behind. We are now, of those 6 years, we're now second from first in terms of chilling hours, because we're literally getting 24 chilling hours every 24 hours for the last week. So that's pretty good, I guess, if you're a fruit tree. People are getting a little cranky, but
but the good thing is, when you live here in Davis or the Sacramento area, you can just drive up to the foothills and you get up the hill just a little way.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's bright sunshine, it's warmer, and you're looking out over the sea of white, fluffy stuff.
People keep telling me that. One of our customers was up in Donner a couple days ago. It was in the 50s and sunny and clear and gorgeous. Of course, it was much colder at night, but it was warmer in Donner than in Davis if you folks aren't from the area, Donner's at rather high elevation. It was warmer in San Francisco than Davis. Mm-hmm. And here's my favorite, since I grew up down there. It was 80 degrees in San Diego yesterday.
Oh, my. I know so, where I'm going for my vacation.
Yeah, Southern California is having a lovely winter, and it's been in the upper 70s to 80 degrees. San Diego, much of the Los Angeles basin as well. I mean, I grew up there. People came to La Jolla in the winter because of the weather. Well, that's why. It's sunny and lovely. We had many Christmas dinners out on the patio right there on the coast of Southern California. Well, it's finally going to break up a little bit, although they're not absolutely sure, because this keeps, you know, it just has been more persistent than usual. We're still okay on rainfall. The reservoirs are still okay, but almost no snowpack yet. But it looks like a break in the weather finally next week. Let's see what the Weather Service is actually saying in terms of the forecast discussion, because they'll acknowledge their indecision on this. The pattern is expected to persist through the week, even into the weekend, as this high-pressure ridge continues to build. Dry weather continues across the region. Well, dry in the sense of no rain. The exception of this is periods of mist and drizzle at times with the low clouds and fog, which, as they say here, may wet the ground. The low clouds continue to keep high temperatures unseasonably cool in the valley and delta. How cool? Well, about 10 to 15 degrees below normal. Higher terrain experiences sunny skies and above normal temperatures, 10 to 20 degrees above normal. The building high pressure will bring further warming to the area over higher terrain, generally for locations above 1,500 feet. Next week, a pattern change is projected for early in the week. There remains quite a bit of uncertainty in the timing and intensity of this system. Current forecast shows the potential for rain north of I-80, especially for the mountains. Best chances over the mountains of Shasta County, little to no impacts expected at this point. This system could, however, end this stagnant pattern. Stay tuned for forecast updates. Question I keep getting about this, one, should we water? No need to water right now. No need to water. The evapotranspiration rate is zero. Plants are not using water at all. It's 100% humidity or close to it. Another nearby weather station, it was all 93 to 95% humidity. Davis weather station, literally 100% humidity for 7 days straight now. When we are transplanting things at our garden center, we're shifting some small seedlings into bigger pots and transplanting, you know, some 1 gallon things into 5 gallon. We do water those, not because the plants are using water, but to settle the soil and get them ready, you know, basically to help them root in better. Other than that, we are doing a little watering on bedding stuff, things in very small pots. They probably don't absolutely need it, but, you know, a 6-pack of cabbage with an inch of roots in soil does need water. So we've been doing that. That's about it. And people are asking about things they've newly planted. You should, of course, water at the time of planting to settle the soil and create the watering basin and all that kind of thing. And then, no, they're not needing, even newly planted plants have not needed water over the last 2 weeks on my property. I've been walking around checking all these 1 gallon trees I put in a couple weeks ago. They're fine. They don't need any attention. The only concern I have is when this type of thing clears out, it's either usually from a storm or a north wind. If it's a north wind, that'll be dry. None of that on the horizon, but keep this in the back of your mind. When that finally comes in, clears things out, the humidity can be substantially lower. Newly planted plants, particularly seedlings, may need some water at that point. Other than that, really no watering needed right now. Thank you all of you who donated on Big Day of Giving. And if you didn't get a chance to do so, and you're one of those people that likes to do end of year giving, well, two of my favorite organizations in the world are KDRT, which is part of Davis Media Access. You can go to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And of course, putting on another hat, Tree Davis, which you can go to treedavis.org and click on a support button there. So if you would kindly add us to your end of year donation list, that would be wonderful. Thanks for listening, and we appreciate your contributions. We have an announcement. Do you have an announcement there?
Well, we usually talk about one of the shows on the station.
Yeah.
And this time, I want to talk about my show. So I went through my collection of Christmas music. So next Tuesday, my show will be on at noon, and it will be Christmas music. And I hope you enjoy it.
That's life.
That's life.
And it broadcasts
Tuesdays at noon.
There you go, kdrt.org.
So the other announcement I want to make is we talked last week about the Christmas bird count is coming up on Sunday, December 21st. And Don, I am going to share screen with you right now and say, what do you see?
I see a black bird with a really bad hangover because its eyes are really red.
And it's got these hairs standing up.
Standing up. Yeah, it had a bad night. This like bird a had a bad night. It's got bed so, hair and it's got red eyes. Okay, it's so, I'll be specific. It's a red-eyed blackbird.
No.
No.
It is a black bird, but it's not a blackbird. This is a Phainopepla.
I'm sorry?
Phainopepla.
Phainopepla.
There's not too many in the world. It's not like a sparrow or something, but it is very interesting. And we have them in Yolo County. And there is one of the places in the count circle. It includes resident population of these birds. By the way, this is the male. Female looks different. Okay. So here I'm showing Don the count circle. And what it is a 15-mile wide circle. It's in the foothills. So it has a little bit of the valley and a little bit of the foothills. It's up towards Leif Berryessa. It includes the city of Winters.
People who live here would go, if you're driving out 128, it goes right through the middle of this count circle.
If you go to the website, Yolo Bird Alliance, then you can sign up for this and you can pick one of those circles. There's a map. Yep. Or you can pick it by organizer. Or you can pick it by your interests or capabilities. And in fact, one of the circles, Area 9, which includes Solano Park, is perfect for people who have difficulty walking.
Limited mobility.
This is the perfect one for you because they go out to the lake and then they have spotting scopes and they try to count all the numbers of all the birds on the lake. It's an interesting challenge. Anyway, it is coming up and I hope that a lot of you will do it, even if you don't know what the birds are. Yeah. You could be a pointer. You can go, psst, there's a bird in that bush.
So the Phainopepla is a silky flycatcher.
Yes, it is.
It's a silky flycatcher, and it has a symbiotic relationship with desert mistletoe. This appears to be about the furthest north that it goes from the looks of the range in Wikipedia.
He looked it up.
I'm San Joaquin Valley, but it goes over to southern Utah. So the fact that it's up here in Sacramento Valley is a little interesting. So they do eat small insects, fruits, and vegetables.
They do not. They're not ground feeders, Don.
Okay, good. YOLOBirdAlliance.org gives you information, and I do love the recent sightings. November 2025, a fog-filled November was brightened by several exceptional rarities. A sagebrush sparrow shocked birders following its discovery along County Road 152. It says, look out for shocked birders when you're out doing the Christmas bird count.
Okay, enough of that. Now let's get on to our...
Yeah, let's talk about how dismal the weather is and what impact that's having on people, aside from the fact that nobody wants to go outside and do anything right now because it's 45 degrees and has been for 2 weeks. I'm getting a lot of interesting calls and questions about things that wouldn't, I think, normally be as much of a concern. One in particular, flowers are molding. I've mentioned this, you know, we get this kind of weather, 100% humidity, the cyclamen at my nursery, the pansies, even the snapdragons, the flowers that are on them presently are just getting covered with gray mold and we're just cutting them off. So the question was, well, are they done? No. And that's a reasonable question, actually, because they look like they're kind of dying. Those flowers are done. Tug them off if you have the inclination. Definitely a good thing to do with your cyclamen, because I have seen this Botrytis gray mold progress from older petals into the stem, into the bulb itself, and kill the plant.
Oh, that's it.
So, but it takes, you know, 10 days of 100% humidity for that to happen. That never happens here, right?
Wait a minute, Don. We've had 10 days of 100%.
Yes.
Oh, my. I better run outside and go and look at my cyclamen and see if any of them have gray mold.
Well, and one thing is, even though we're having almost no air circulation, literally the air, you know, the wind speed over the last 10 days has been maximum like 2 to 3 miles an hour, which means pretty much non-existent. What we do when we have a display of cyclamen, for example, is we move them out into the open if we can, rather than under an overhang, as is at our garden center, because you have slightly better air circulation, and we spread them out. We spread them out so the plants aren't touching. That seems to make a big difference, because when they're packed into the flats, like you see at most garden centers, if you get a little bit of botrytis mold on a plant in the corner, next drizzle, it'll splash to the next plant and the next plant. And pretty soon, all of them are showing it. Whereas if they're not touching, if they're spread out and there's a little bit of air circulation around them, the problem is confined and usually just doesn't get that bad. You know, the enemy of fungus is sunlight and wind. We're not having any sunlight. We're barely having any wind, but at least you can give them a chance by spreading them a little further apart. We're constantly making jokes about get a hair dryer out here or something to clean it.
That was a fan.
Shaking the droplets off of the flowers is helpful, believe it or not. This is one case where that might be useful, and pulling them off, tugging them off of there. The other question, we'll sort of launch right into one of the topics that I believe is on our list. People wondering about why this particular plant is looking so dreary or looks like it's dying. Is it deciduous or what? Three people have asked about their hydrangeas. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, hydrangeas are deciduous. And in a normal year, we'd have periods as it's getting colder, the leaves would yellow, it would drop its leaves like normal. A lot of them, we had a long period in early November that was warmer than average, if you can recall that. First 2 weeks of November were warm and pleasant, and we just weren't going into dormancy for a lot of plants. Remember, we had no chilling hours by the middle of November. And then the cold came on, shall we say, rather suddenly and intensely, but not
precipitously.
There you go. Precipitously without precipitation and not effectively. This is the other thing. We didn't have a transition. We went very abruptly. And so a lot of hydrangeas, I've had two pictures sent to me where the leaves are yellowing and dropping. And I just had to assure them that's actually what they do. And if someone gives you a hydrangea at this time of year, because they're a popular florist gift item, you have them at the grocery store or someplace like that. That plant is going to go through a rather abrupt transition if you put it outside. It's going to look like it's dying. And all you do is cut off the spent blossoms when they're done, set it out where it'll get watered more or less automatically by the current weather. Put it in the ground if you want to. It's a perfectly fine time to plant if your soil isn't too muddy. Then in most cases, people are actually finding the soil still pretty workable. And just watch it go dormant. That's what's going to happen. That's perfectly normal. We've had a couple people concerned about certain other plants, and this is true every year, but it's especially true this year just because of their appearance. Figs, fruiting mulberries in some cases. Wait.
Figs?
We'll be back. We'll go through three. Figs, fruiting mulberries, and now if I can remember what the other one was. Oh, Vitex, the chaste tree. These are deciduous plants. Fig trees are deciduous, the fig that you eat, the fruiting fig. But they don't turn color. They don't form a nice clean abscission layer like a maple or an oak does. So the leaves don't, well, in the case of oaks, some of those hang on there. Well, in the case of figs, they droop and then they sort of lose color and then they fall off. So they really do look like they're dying. They don't turn yellow or red or something that makes you go, ah, fall is here. The figs are going dormant. No, they just look like they're dying.
If you have figs, you're used to this every year.
Hopefully, but every year it seems we get someone that's concerned about it because they don't look like it's an actual normal dormancy, but that really is all that's happening. And there's some of the mulberries, not your big fruitless mulberry, that drops leaves like a normal tree, but some of the fruiting ones do the same thing, the smaller ones that we grow for the fruit, and particularly Vitex, which is becoming kind of increasingly popular here. That's the chaste tree with a palmate leaf and a lovely bushy growth habit, gets big enough to be an alternative to crepe myrtle, has blue flowers in the summer, same summer bloom season as crepe myrtle. So they're becoming increasingly popular as crepe myrtles are sort of falling out of favor due to the aphid problem that they have. Well, chaste tree does the same thing as figs. They just, the leaves just sort of barely turn yellow if at all, and then they just fall off. That's normal. That's their normal dormancy cycle. So I just want people to be aware that some things that should go dormant, do so in a less obvious manner. And then some things that should be dead by now, like cannas and impatiens, are still out there trying to go on because we haven't had actual freezing weather. So it's a little dreary and strange out there. Combination of gray mold, plants going dormant that we can't really tell, plants that should be dead by now but aren't. A little bit different than the usual pattern that we have in early December.
All right, let's expand this a little bit and talk about the dormancy of things that, well, roses.
Yeah.
My roses are never dormant.
I have,
because they always have leaves.
Pretty much. Roses with China rose parentage, which is Rosa chinensis, which is a really important introduction to rose breeding 300 years ago, came from warmer parts of China. And we're typically more, I won't call them subtropical, but they don't really go into a proper dormancy. On the other hand, roses from northern parentage, many North American species, for example, turn color, drop their leaves, you know, function like an actual proper deciduous plant. Out in my field right now, I have a Cordisii hybrid. If you're a rose lover, this is a climbing form of Rosa Cordisii parentage. And that's not the actual species, but that's what we call it because that's the breeding company that introduced me. It's got bright yellow fall color and it's about to go completely dormant. It does this every year. I went out and took some pictures of it today. Really nice fall color on a rose. We don't usually tout them for that particular thing. Right across the field there from it out in my pasture area, I have straight China roses, Rosa chinensis, such as Old Blush or a couple of others, in bloom. And they bloom right through the winter for me every year. They never go dormant. Having first been introduced to roses in San Diego in a frost-free climate, we were given rose pruning advice. We were always told to prune them on January 1. Why not? Might as well follow the calendar. And they were never dormant. They were always blooming. It's 80 degrees in San Diego yesterday, so they don't ever get a proper dormancy cycle, but you prune them for size control, disease management, all those other reasons that people who prune roses like to use. And so you would do it in January, just like anywhere else. They were never out of leaf and they were never out of bloom. In climates like Northern California, they go out of bloom, but the plants don't properly drop all their leaves depending on their parentage. You prune them anyway, you don't worry about all that. But it is the nature of roses. First of all, there's tens, hundreds of thousands of varieties with significant differences in the parentage. And that makes a big difference into whether they have a proper dormancy cycle. Some of them are basically evergreen. Cecil Bruner is an evergreen rose. Lady Banks is an evergreen rose. The China roses are evergreen in this climate and certainly in Southern California. It's the hybrid teas, which is still the dominant category of roses in the market. Whether you're thinking of a long stem cutting rose, you're probably thinking of a hybrid tea rose. They have China rose parentage, but the other part of their parentage was roses from colder climates. So they typically do drop their leaves, sort of, usually every year, mostly, but not always. Prune them anyway. Don't worry about it. And of course, that old advice, strip all the rest of the leaves off to reduce disease spores overwintering. I guess that's helpful if you have the inclination or the patience to do that. But you go ahead and prune them anyway. And they are variable as to whether or not they drop their leaves. I take pictures of my roses year round just to show the different patterns of growth and bloom. And there are three or four that I have that bloom right through the winter. In fact, can look very, very nice in the winter time. So we'll talk about those in a moment.
All right. The other question that I have, which has to do with dormancy, is if your fruit trees are dormant, then you can spray at certain times for certain things.
Yep.
What if your fruit trees, I mean, are there any fruit trees other than citrus that are not dormant?
Well, yes, many subtropical fruits, most of the ones that would not be dormant are evergreen. And so you wouldn't really be thinking of them the same way, but your guavas and things like that. And generally, we don't do any spraying on those anyway. So the advice is going out there. All the gardening folks and master gardeners are writing columns and about the dormant spray recommendations. This has been a fascination of mine for as long as I've been in business, that the recommendations that are made to home gardeners aren't similar at all to what farmers do. And that many people read these checklists of spray this with this, spray that with that. Do I really have to do that? And my answer to you in this climate is no, you don't actually have to do all of that. And you can just be aware of what the consequences will be. Your tree won't die. You will still get fruit. You'll get perfectly good fruit if you never spray them in our climate. There are places where you can't grow peaches without spraying them. There are plums without spraying them, apricots without spraying them. But in this area, it's not absolutely essential. More to the point, what concerns me about this advice that's put out there every year, year after year, is that the spray materials changed rather dramatically about 12 to 13 years ago. Both of the major spray materials that had been used that were effective were taken off the market, one by regulatory action, the other by decision by the manufacturer. So the fixed copper sulfate and the lime sulfur, which were very effective sprays for particular diseases of deciduous fruit trees, were taken away. They're gone. They are not available in California. They may be available elsewhere, but I don't think so. The lime sulfur, I think, is fixed copper sulfate is not. And so I remember having a back and forth with the people in charge of what was then called ipm.ucdavis.edu site, now ucanr.edu. You know, she was contacting me about what are you guys going to recommend, since you can't sell these products anymore. And I said, well, what we have to recommend is liquid copper. Liquid copper, which is 8% active ingredient, compared to fixed copper, which was 50% active ingredient, liquid copper is not very effective. Bluntly, walk into my nursery. That's what I'm going to sell you because it's what I have. It's what's available. Commercial growers use fungicides, actual, fungicides that are registered for use on fruit trees, which you typically cannot buy. But fixed liquid copper doesn't work very well. It really doesn't work much on peach leaf curl. It is somewhat helpful, in my opinion, based on efficacy data that I've seen on preventing things like brown rot on apricots and such, but not sprayed now. So the old rule that you're going to see out there is to spray right now as the leaves are dropping, spray again late December, early January. Can't remember what that one's all about. And really important one, spray right before bud break, which in our climate is early February, if you're spraying for peach leaf curl. The first one is the one where there's a lot of confusion. They tell people to spray now for leaf curl. I don't think spraying in late November, or early December has the slightest efficacy on peach leaf curl, particularly not when you're using an 8% active ingredient copper spray. The one thing you would be spraying for now is shot hole disease. Shot hole fungus, shot hole disease does affect apricots in particular, sometimes peaches and plums, especially on a lot of the foliage. So if you had a lot of what looked like something eating holes in the leaves of your plum or apricot or peach in late spring, and you're sure it wasn't something eating holes in the leaves because you see the infection point before it drops out, that's shot hole disease, shot hole fungus. And right now is the time to spray for that if you've had a big problem with it. It is one case where the disease can affect the fruit because it can get on the peel and cause an area on that that's not just unattractive, but kind of tougher. You can cut it out. You can still eat it. It doesn't rot the fruit, but it's unsightly. So people who have a big problem with the shot hole disease do like to spray. Liquid copper will probably help somewhat. More importantly, raking up those leaves and getting rid of them, just not letting them. This is one case where I'll tell you to take them somewhere else. I don't want them lying on the ground underneath the fruit tree and decomposing there because the disease is on the leaves. At least if you had a bad problem, raking up the leaves, getting to bare orchard soil underneath the tree could be helpful. You can certainly spread them out elsewhere in your yard. You can put them in your compost pile, a properly functioning compost pile will take care of the problem. But if you had a problem with shot hole disease, raking up the leaves when they've all fallen down, taking them away, if you want to spray, this is the timing for that particular spray.
Two questions. One is, does shot hole disease affect anything other than pitted fruit?
Stone fruits are what it attacks. So no, the answer to your question is no, that whole group. Okay. So stone fruits is a term we use for apricots, peaches, nectarines, plums, pluots, cherries.
I feel like Aprium.
Aprium. I think that's it.
So the second question is, you've been talking about shot hole disease.
Yep.
Is there also a shot hole borer?
Yes, there is. And that's a different beast. The shot hole borer is an actual insect that attacks trees, makes tiny, it looks somewhat like someone took a 1/8-inch drill bit or smaller and made holes all up and down a branch. A little squiggly resin is coming out. Shot hole borer, when you have it on a tree, is a sign that the tree is dying. So there's no spray that I would even use for that. It tells you that that whole part of the tree is dying and decaying to the point that these decomposition borers are coming in. And you might as well plan on taking at least that part of the tree out, if not the whole tree.
Yeah, but I mean, it didn't cause the death.
Correct. It gets blamed for it, but didn't cause it.
Yeah, well, you know, that's true of a lot of things in this world.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about something else. Something a little more cheerful. Roses that bloom in the winter. Now, you talked about a couple of things that you had, but...
Yeah, China roses in particular, that's a big category of roses. And you'll mostly find them on the websites and selling sites of specialty nurseries. Rosa chinensis was imported into the U.S., as I said, 300 plus years ago. And they're from warmer parts of China, so they don't have a full-on dormancy. And they became very, very popular in the United States, in the southeastern U.S., Louisiana, Texas, places like that, South Carolina, climates that are relatively mild, compared to further north. And these are roses that you can just stick a branch in the ground, it'll grow. So Old Blush is a really good example, introduced in the 1750s into the United States. That's how long we've been growing this Rosa chinensis, Old Blush, in the United States. Thomas Jefferson, people like him who are avid gentleman gardeners of the time, would import these from the UK. Imagine that. Send your order off. Deal with. I have no idea what kind of currency they used in the time. And then wait for the ship to arrive. Couple months later, hopefully the cuttings are still alive. And he imported lots of apples and roses and things that way. The China roses caught on very quickly in milder climates. They are killed in cold climates. If you're listening in Michigan, you're not going to do China roses except under glass. But they became very popular in the southern, southeastern U.S. and in California also. And Old Blush is a really good example. For a long time, there was, might still be there, planting a hedge of it on Willowbank Road in South Davis, right as you drove along there near the bridge. Long stretch of a rose that had pink flowers that I'm almost certain was Old Blush. China roses, that's the name you should look at if you're looking these up online, China roses. They're from Rosa chinensis, or at least they were under the last version of rose taxonomy that I looked at. That's being updated all the time. Another very good one, I'll say it slowly, Cramoisie Superieure.
That's French.
It is indeed. So we need to give it an Anglo name if we ever want to sell it. It's a red flowered one. My plant after 4 years is about 7 by 7. I never prune it. You can clip them as a hedge if you want to. Same thing with Old Blush. And I have pictures of each of these blooming in December, January, February, blooming New Year's Eve in full bloom. And the flowers are not particularly affected by the weather. I will say about the China roses, these are ones that you stick in the back corner. You have an informal garden with a border of you know, naturalizing perennials and wildflowers. They'd be a perfect addition to that. If you do nothing, they typically get 6 to 7 feet across, have a sort of a sprawling growth habit. If that's not the kind of look you like, you can clip them. You can actually prune them with hedge shears if you're so inclined. And I've seen pictures of these where, you know, down in Louisiana or eastern Texas, where roses are very, very popular, where people just stick a branch in the ground every 3 feet and now you have a hedge. I mean, they're that easy to grow. They like water. Roses are not particularly drought tolerant, so put them in a place where you'll be giving at least once a week through a really thorough watering. They can recover from drought, but they look best if they're irrigated. And the one thing I will mention, Rosa chinensis brought powdery mildew into rose breeding, unfortunately. All of these get a little bit of powdery mildew. It's enough that if you're a rose expert and you walk up and look at the plant, you can see there's a little bit of mildew on the new growth. That's it. It's not destroying the appearance. It's a mild aesthetic concern, and it's nothing that you would even want to bother for spraying for, because the plants are perfectly healthy otherwise and bloom like crazy. So Rosa chinensis as a group, the China roses in particular, heirloom roses, antique rose emporium, Rogue Valley roses, these are companies that are online. They're the only places you're going to find most of these, although I do have these. So if you have an interest in China roses, send me a note. redwoodbarn@gmail.com is probably best. We'll take a cutting for you. We'll go ahead and get one started because they're that easy to grow.
Cramoisie Superieure. I looked it up and the translation is a superior crimson or crimson superior.
There we go. All right, so I can change the name on the label. That'll sell a lot better. One thing we found in the rose biz is that for whatever reason, Americans won't buy roses with foreign names, even though you would think French would make it sound elegant and lovely and so on.
While we're talking about roses, why don't you tell me what roses you can grow for partial shade? Okay. I know you did. You were doing a little homework because I had that shady spot. And what did you come up with?
I've done several roses in shade by accident. In other words, I planted them in sun, planted trees, now they're in shade.
That happens, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. It does, all over my property. And gradually it became too shady for most of the roses. So I dug them out, moved them. But the ones that were doing well, I left. And some of these get actually no direct sun now. It's bright because it's trees like birch trees. It's not, you know, great big old mulberry or something. But I will mention a couple that have done very well in that situation. Jean Warner is a floribunda rose that goes way back to the 1960s, named after a very famous rose breeder. It really should have caught on because they're perfect little pink roses. There's 50 to 100 at a time on the plant. It grows to about 5 feet tall. It never gets disease problems. They don't happen to be fragrant, so maybe that's why it never sold real well. It's been in, actually, this is an interesting fact. I've had 5 or 6 rose gardens where I've lived over the years, and this one has been in every one of them. It's one of the few roses that I've made a point of planting in each of my rose gardens simply because of its performance. And in the shade, it's a little more open, a little taller, but otherwise a very attractive plant, which is important to me. Jean Borner, and the next one, Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is a Jackson and Perkins introduction from about 25 years ago. Phenomenal garden plant. It's a Floribunda rose in the sun. It's a tight grower, about 4x4. Again, 50 to 60 medium pink blooms at a time on the plant. In the shade, it's about a 6-foot plant with a more open habit, but very attractive. And that'll be a hard one to find unless you order directly from Jackson and Perkins, which still does exist as an internet sales company. We've been propagating it ourselves because we've been really impressed with it as a landscape plant, as well as for its for the bloom. So Our Lady of Guadalupe. Here's one that would be easy to look for. Julia Child. She did see this when it was introduced, by the way. The flower is the color of butter, very appropriately. And it's a great plant. It's a big one. Mine's in complete but bright shade, and the plant is about 6x6 and does very well. It has no disease problems. Iceberg is right next to it. Iceberg Rose is unbelievably successful almost anywhere. Full sun, figure 4 to 5 feet. Shade, figure 6 feet, a little more informal growth habit, but very attractive. And there's a burgundy iceberg and a brilliant pink iceberg, which are naturally occurring variants of iceberg that are just as good. So iceberg is a good one. Mine happens to be right next to Julia Child, which makes a great combination. I'll mention two others that you won't find quite as readily, but they're worth looking for. Zephyrine Druhan. There's a name, Zephyrine.
Another foreign word.
Druhan. And this is a climber with pink flowers, thornless, and takes shade and disease-free. So there's a good one, and it's lightly fragrant. And then another one is Hot Cocoa, which came on the market 25 plus years ago. Its flower was described as brown, which I can tell you from a retail standpoint, it's not a selling point, but it's not brown. It's buff orange red. How's that? Which is brown, but the flower is really, really interesting. It's almost impossible to photograph it correctly. It's one of those ones where you take a picture and it looks red, or it just doesn't portray well, but it's a great garden plant with a really elegant flower and another one with a fairly open habit, very similar to iceberg. So they go well together. And in fact, my Hot Cocoa is right near my Julia Child and my iceberg. Those three make an excellent combination in bright shade. And for those of you in the southeastern U.S., or you want one of those informal roses that you see at the cemeteries and churches and old cottages in the downtown areas down there, in South Carolina, a breed of roses came out in the 19th century called the noisette roses. I saw my first noisette rose in Fort Bragg, California, not the one in Carolina, the one in California, where the temperature is pretty much always 60 degrees and foggy. And it was flourishing. It was the only rose in the garden at the Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens that I thought looked really good as a landscape plant, as well as being in full bloom. I thought, this is years ago. I thought, well, it does great there. Will it do well in the valley? Yes, and it will do well in bright shade. And it's a big plant. It's kind of a climber, 6x6 easily. Big clusters of blooms, fragrant in the evening. It's one of those, fragrant just at sunset and into the early evening. And the noisette roses, which sound French, were actually from South Carolina. The nurseryman who introduced them was named Noisette. And they've done very well down there and do quite well here in California. And they are also shade tolerant. So that's a handful of roses for part shade, just from my own experience. And I can tell you also, Cecil Bruner, both the shrub form and the climbing form, are also shade tolerant. And my probable favorite in this whole category is the Persian musk rose, Rosa moscata. Nastarana. Nastarana is the name to look for in catalogs and online. Nastarana. Been around for a couple hundred years. Another one fragrant in the evening with that sweet honeysuckle scent and shade tolerant.
And are any of these ones that rebloom, or are they all ones that they have a set period and for 2 weeks they're beautiful and then they're just a bush?
All of these rebloom.
So, all of these rebloom.
Yeah. So unlike, say, the Lady Banks rose, where it's like the 10 days you have everybody over to look at your Lady Banks rose, that's it for the year. No, these are repeat bloomers, all of them.
Well, enough about roses, Don. Let's talk about grass.
Okay.
We got a message from Ilya. I said, we did some remodeling this summer, and our grass area in the backyard got destroyed in the process by machinery and foot traffic. So having all options available to look at for revitalizing, we did some research and discovered California buffalo grass, also called UC Verde grass. Are you familiar with this type of ground cover? Please share your opinion. Internet says all the things we want to hear. However, it would be nice to have a second expert opinion. Many thanks in advance. And Ilya is in Tiburon, which is in the Bay Area.
Buffalo grass, when I was a student, was being touted as the next great thing in turf grass, because it is tough. It's interesting they're calling it California because it's actually native to Oklahoma, Texas, places like that, arid western states, a wide stretch of the middle of the United States, including some very dry and very hot regions. There is a hybrid, I assume it's a hybrid, or at least a cultivar selection called UC Verde, which came on the market 40 or 50 years ago, at least. So the University of California had the original patent for it. And it was selected simply for the shorter dormant season and a little bit stronger color. Buffalo grass grows a lot like Bermuda grass, but less rampantly. In other words, it spreads as a rhizome and creeps outward from where you plant it and fills in pretty quickly. I had one customer who actually took pictures during the whole process of changing over his backyard from whatever turf he had, killing that out, planting buffalo grass by hand, which is what you do. You're planting it like a ground cover. You're not scattering seed like most grass. You're not scattering stolons like Bermuda grass. You're getting starts and you're planting them out individually like a ground cover. So that part of it is somewhat tedious because you're hand planting individual plants. And he took pictures over the course of the summer. It basically took all summer to fill. And remember that buffalo grass, like Bermuda grass, is, I won't call it subtropical, but it's a warm season grass. It only grows in the warm season and it's dormant in the winter time. So you're not going to plant it in December, January. You're going to plant it mid to late spring or any time during the summer. He did find that weed management was something he had to do at first because you're planting these individual plants about a foot apart and you've got open soil, weeds are going to come in. Eventually, depending on what the weeds are, as the grass covers and you mow it, you'll probably kill out most of them that way. But that is something to be aware of. By the end of the summer, it looked very good and it made a very nice cover. And then this is the important part. It does have a fall dormant season starting about December in our climate going into about March. Tiburon could be greening up earlier, hard to say. The advantage of UC Verde was that the dormant season would end in March. Traditional buffalo grass didn't even end until April. So that was one big advantage of the UC Verde. More consistent growth habit, shorter dormancy, and a somewhat greener color, hence the name UC Verde. It does use a lot less water than a regular grass. It can be as little as 50% or even 30% of the rate of water use of a traditional turf. And I don't know where you're going to find information except that it is only sold by one company, ucverde.com. And it's not they have exclusive rights to it anymore because I'm sure the patent on this expired a long, long time ago. They're just the only ones producing it. They would ship it out to you in ground cover trays, basically, in the spring or early summer. So you go to their website and you get information from them about when and how they ship it out. It can be watered as little as once a week here in the valley. So you could water as little as every 10 to 14 days in Tiburon would be my guess. In a drought emergency, such as we have every now and then, where the state wants people to cut back, you could probably stop watering Bermuda grass or buffalo grass completely, or water them once a month just to keep them alive, and they would recover. So one of the things that I started adding to my notes about turf grass years ago was drought recovery. How well does it, if you shut off the water, does it come back when you turn the water back on? Buffalo grass will come back. It has pretty good drought recovery. Fescue grasses tend to have pretty good drought recovery. Bluegrass, by comparison, you go all summer without water, well, you've killed it. So there are grasses that have good drought recovery and that don't. So the only downside on this is that your lawn will look kind of like a Bermuda grass lawn does from December through February, which is brown. If it's uniform, the whole thing is buffalo grass or the whole thing is Bermuda grass, it doesn't look so bad. It just looks dormant. It's when you get weeds in there, like grassy weeds, especially that have invaded like a Poa annua, the annual bluegrass, will show up and you'll have patches of green in the brown and then it looks weedy because you have some things that are alive and some things that look dead, although they're technically dormant. Other than that, dormant season is a tough grass. You can mow it very short. This is a case where short mowing is absolutely fine. So if you happen to use your turf for croquet or things like that, buffalo grass would be a great choice for that kind of purpose. So really the downside is the winter appearance, and that's about it. And the fact that it's pretty slow to get going, that was his comment. A lot of work to plant it, pretty slow to fill in, but as he put it then, basically indestructible was the term he used at that point. So it may take you a year to have your backyard looking the way you want it, but then once it is, it's pretty hard to go wrong. Unlike Bermuda grass, which it resembles in many ways, yes, it creeps out by rhizomes, but it doesn't run 4 feet into the nearby border by rhizomes. It creeps outward, and you can see what's happening, and it's not going to get away from you. Bermuda grass lawn, and Bermuda grass is a perfectly acceptable turf as long as you know all the downsides. One of the biggest is it invades all the nearby beds and borders and is really a hassle to manage. Buffalo grass is not likely to ever become that kind of a problem. It creeps steadily, not rampantly. UCVerde.com gives you the information you need. I think very highly of buffalo grass. It never caught on as the newest, latest, greatest coming thing because of the winter dormancy is the primary factor for that.
Well, I guess I will ask you what you're doing this week. I mean, it's the middle of December. It's a drizzle out. I mean, the only thing I can see is if I have to go out and I get out in the car and I drive out and I come back and I look down at the ground right next to the car door and I look at weeds.
Yes, weeds are out there.
The bed straw, the sticky Velcro weed.
Yeah,
and it's all it's there. It's
already 6 inches tall.
How can it grow when it's only 40 degrees out?
Well, it's not growing as much as it was 2 weeks ago, but it's definitely growing. There's plenty of soil moisture, plenty of weeds out there. We're moving tarps around to cover them. We're hoeing things off, actually mowing them off if you can do it. The one thing about mowing weeds is it just the mower bogs down when it's this wet. So that doesn't work real well. A weed eater will work, but it's splattering stuff all over the place when you do it. Wear clothing that you're going to wash right away. But I would smother them if you possibly can, or take a hoe to that Velcro weed, that bed straw, because it is, 6 inches tall. It's way ahead of schedule this year. So it'll be blooming and probably setting seed before our normal pattern of February to March. It'd probably be January. Get out there and get that under control if you possibly can. What am I planting? I'm about to plant snapdragons. We grew from seed some of the long stem cutting snapdragons, and I want to try out some of these old fashioned early 20th century varieties. I'll give you a full report next year after they've bloomed. These are the ones that are grown for cut flowers, so they're big plants, the UC hybrids and some of the others. I'm about to plant some broccolini, and what I'm going to do there is I have a planter that's about not quite as big as a half barrel, but it's maybe 20 inch diameter, 18 inch diameter, and it's already got soil in it that had some summer herbs in it. So I'm just going to top dress that with some of our fancy potting soil and put in one whole 6 pack of broccolini into the barrel. They'll be about 8 inches apart, so that's crowded, but it doesn't matter in the case of broccolini because you're not aiming for a large head, you're aiming for small side shoots. I also have a little thing of lettuce to plant in a smaller container out there, and I'm going to be putting in, let's see, what's the other thing that's, oh yes, Iceland poppies. I'm going to be doing a planting of Iceland poppies as well. Those are all things you can plant right now. There are flowers that you can put in now for bloom next spring and summer. There's things you can put in now for bloom whenever the fog clears out. That would be the pansies and violas and the dwarf snapdragons and the cyclamen, things like that. And still leafy greens, spinach, beets, Swiss chard, broccolini, broccoli rabe, bok choy. Those can all go in now. Those are all things that you can plant right on through the winter, and you can harvest them essentially as soon as you're ready for them. These are things that you'd pick a little bit steadily, the plant continues typically through the month of March. Question I got the other day, if I buy this fast-growing cabbage now, early December, when will I be harvesting it? Probably the first week or so of March would be pretty typical at this point. Now, when you plant them and it's 44 degrees, day after day after day after day after day.
It's not going to do anything.
They're not going to do much of anything right after you plant them. Yes, be aware of that. You're putting them in. They're not going to die. You water them in to settle the soil, and they're not going to do much of anything until the sun comes out again. But they will grow when the clouds finally part and we see sunlight.
We're in Davis. What apples do well here in Davis? Do you have any list of varieties that we should look for?
We are not really apple country. We're not going to grow Macintosh or Rome Beauty or some of the familiar ones from Michigan or the Northeast or places like that because of the nature of our late summer and fall weather here. They may in some cases grow fine, but you'll find the texture is not as pleasant. They aren't as juicy as they would be back there. This isn't really apple country for those types. The ones that we do recommend, Fuji grows everywhere in the world, as far as I can tell. Fuji, Braeburn, Gala. Those are three right there. And all those are reasonably self-fruitful and good producers. So Fuji, Braeburn, Gala. Those are ones that do well here in the Valley. Question?
But don't we have codling moths? Isn't that why we don't grow apples here?
Well, that's not the only reason. There's three basic factors with apples. One is the chilling hour. Some apples need really high chilling. And I have a pippin that I was given by a wholesale grower 35 years ago to test it and has never flowered or fruited for me. So I'll say my test, it fails. It's still out there. It's a perfectly nice tree and I have no reason to take it out except for the complete lack of apples. But it needs 1,200 chilling hours and we don't usually get that here. So chilling hours are one thing. And if you're listening in coastal areas or Southern California, they're a very important thing. However, we do know that many, many apple varieties will fruit adequately or sometimes very well outside of the range of where they should based on chilling hours. It seems in the case of apples, it's more how they get the chilling than exactly what amount they get. Because there have been regions growing apples in California, up in the hills above Los Angeles, hills behind San Diego, places that shouldn't really be getting enough chilling for them, but they do just fine. So don't be completely deterred by a list that you're looking at and you see it needs 600 chilling hours and you only get 400 where you are. It'll probably fruit for you. But the first one is chilling hours. Some varieties are strictly northern varieties. Fire blight susceptibility is a problem on apples. You'll find charts that show lists that are resistant or susceptible. My experience has been the overlap of resistant varieties and the ones that do well in the Valley is very limited. So I don't go on that because you'd have nothing left. So we don't worry too much about fire blight. We just manage it as best we can. And none of the ones I've mentioned are highly susceptible. So it's a manageable thing. And all apples potentially get codling moth, which is the worm that gets in the fruit. And my experience has been in a heavy crop year, you'll have plenty of fruit out there that don't have worms in them, but the majority will have worms in them. Easy to tell as you look at the fruit. There's things you can try and do about codling moth. It's complicated to try and control codling moth, except for one really simple method that home gardeners have been using for centuries. Protect the fruit. Put a little bag around the fruit. As soon as it forms, cover it with a special fruit bag or a number four sandwich bag or even a plastic bag with a corner cut off so that moisture doesn't condense in it. And that will keep the codling moth from ovipositing on that particular fruit. That one will be worm-free. And as my mother would tell you, it's easy to cut out the worms as well. So you don't get a fruit full of worms. You get a fruit with one worm. You can see it. You can cut it out. You can still use it for applesauce or even eat it directly. So codling moth is a nuisance, but it's something a lot of people just learn to live with. I do recall people from the Bay Area years ago asking me to stock a variety called Anders, A-N-D-E-R-S. Only needed 400 chilling hours. And the company that produced it said resistant to codling moth. I have no idea how an apple would be resistant to codling moth. I don't know what mechanism of the fruit, maybe really tough skin so they can't oviposit. I don't know. Whatever the case, they did mention that one. I'll just pass along that anecdotal comment. Anders variety, if you're in the Bay Area, some nurseries down there might actually carry it for this reason, said to be resistant to codling moth. My experience this year, I have a Fuji and it produced an unusually large crop. We didn't even really notice until they were all beginning to ripen. And there were so many of them that a lot of them had worms, but a lot of them didn't. There were enough of them that didn't have worms that we were perfectly happy. A lot went to waste, but the fair number of them were just fine. Codling moth is one of the things that people need to know about. But there's just a handful that just seem to be consistent performers pretty much everywhere, or at least here in California. I'll throw in Golden Delicious, which seems to grow everywhere. That's just one of the most widely adapted apples. It's one that a lot of people end up with because it has been used, seeds of Golden Delicious have been used as rootstock in years past. And so if an apple died and it came up from the roots, a lot of times you ended up with Golden Delicious. It just seems to fruit practically everywhere. Fuji, Braeburn, Gala, Golden Delicious. I'll mention Gravenstein because that's a classic Northern California heirloom apple. It was brought into the Sebastopol region by the Russians in the early 1800s. It's become the classic apple associated with Sonoma County and the wine country because it was so widely planted over there. It does grow very well here. They're quite delicious. It is one case where I can tell you do need a pollinizer. You need another variety somewhere nearby to cross-pollinize. That's a complicated subject that you get into if you're really super into apples, which ones do and which ones don't, but I will give you a generalization. Most varieties are at least partially self-fruitful. So most homeowners will get enough fruit with just one plant, one tree of a particular variety. The one exception is Gravenstein, which is a classic Northern California apple. It's used for applesauce. It's got wonderful flavor. It's got a mealy texture, which is considered desirable for applesauce. If you pick it a little earlier than fully ripe, it actually is crisp textured and very good here. So those are some that I recommend. And people ask about more obscure varieties. I would just look at the chilling hours and see that it's not way out of range for the region. And look at where it's from. So you know, Honeycrisp came on the market a few years back and people started asking about it because it showed up in the store and it was really sweet. Can we grow this one here? Okay, 800 chilling hours. Yeah, we get that. And they're close enough to that you could probably grow it. But it was from Michigan, I think. Might have been Wisconsin. One of those states way up there. Okay, so not really associated with higher temperature regions. I sold them for a little while. If any of you happen to buy one, have it in production, send me a note about how your Honeycrisp is doing. When a new variety comes on the market, I'm not going to promise anything because we don't have a track record with it. But we just look at whether it's likely to succeed here. That one I still have my reservations about.
Are you harvesting persimmons?
We are harvesting persimmons. Yes, indeed.
Do you need to know anything about persimmons before you harvest them?
Yes, I have two trees, one of which is a fuyu and one of which is a hachia. And we've been harvesting the fuyu, the ones we can reach, for 3 or 4 weeks. The hachia are not ripe yet. And there's an important difference which has to do with the astringency of the fruit. If you want to define the word astringent, take an unripe hachia persimmon, cut it in half, and touch it to your tongue. That's what astringent means. Your tongue will pucker is the term that's commonly used. It's like licking a shag carpet is the way I once saw it described. Whereas the fuyu, it sweetens up, the sugar is in there, and all that astringency goes away as soon as the fruit is coloring. So you can actually pick fuyu in October if they're turning color, November for sure. Fuyu is the one that's flattened on the bottom, and that's the one most people know because you can just go out and pick them right off the tree and eat them like an apple. But if you're a gourmet cook and you like to make persimmon puddin, as my grandmother put it, puddin, you only make that if you can from hachias or other astringent types that are fully ripe and soft, because they are going to be sweeter and richer in flavor, but you got to wait until we've had enough cold weather, enough frost actually, for them to begin to essentially begin the process of spoiling. At that point, they are sweet and ready to go, which in the case of my hachia is usually late December. A lot of work has been done over the years to try and figure out how to make hachia persimmons or other astringent varieties less puckery. And the reason this came up is that I got a Google Analytics report from my website, redwoodbarn.com. And it turned out the one article that had just shot way up in terms of people clicking on it was one that I wrote called Puckery Persimmons? ? So if you have a question about why your persimmons are puckery and what has been done over the years to make persimmons less puckery, or perhaps make puckery persimmons less puckery and therefore more popular with the public. There's a lot of work done by the USDA about 100 years ago to try. One of their jobs has always been to try to introduce new crops to American farmers and American public. They're trying to figure out how to make persimmons more popular. You can read all the details, redwoodbarn.com, puckery persimmons.
And as always, we end our show with a quote. And this time mine is, I like this quote, gardening is an optimistic pastime.
Indeed. Always planning ahead. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.